Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 2, delivered on August 20, 2014. The title of this lecture is Financial Markets and Interest Rates.
Today, financial markets and interest rates. Before I get to that subject, I want to touch on one last important basic concept in finance. It has to do with business organizations, the different kinds of companies and all that. But to start that process off, I've got to ask an important question, which I'm sure you'll be able to answer for me very quickly. What is business? Oh, you can answer, right? What's business? You're going to get a damn major in the subject. See, that's just it. That's okay. I'm actually gaming with you. When I say, well, you're all going to get a degree, it'll say Bachelor of Business Administration. You'll spend 4 years in the College of Business, or at least some of that 4 years. And yet, asking what is business gets to be kind of a complicated thing. Now, I could give you a long-winded definition, but a working definition would be an organized approach to production of a good or service. An organized approach to the production of a good or service. And I have to do that in order to talk about different kinds of businesses as far as structure goes, as far as not just legal structure, but also conceptual structure as well. We are all, now understand, not all businesses are in money to make a profit. So that's not part of a good definition. Some businesses are nonprofits. Some businesses are organized around some charitable mission and all of that. But every business is in one way or another organized. It could be loose or it could be very technically precise. But it's making something. It's making a good or a service or a combination. Some kind of product is coming out of this business. And so I would break down businesses, the structural concept of business, into three kinds. They go from the simplest on through to the most complex. And let's start off. You, sir, have been working on your degree here at Illinois State University, but one night you wake up in a cold sweat and you say, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to live my dream. And what's your dream? Dried flower arrangements sold at flea markets around the Midwest. So you drop out and you just do this. You buy baskets, you buy dried flowers, you buy some nice ribbon and maybe some potpourri, obviously, you know, for the ladies. And dab a little on yourself, too. And you sell them. You realize that your mission in life is not a business degree. You want to mow lawns for wealthy older women. You call yourself cougar bait. And you charge money for them, and they pay you to mow their lawns in a wife beater in very hot, sunny environments where you sweat quite a bit, muscular as you are, but young, quite young. Oh, sorry. God, I want out of this class. You want to walk pets around neighborhoods. That's what you want to do. You don't want a degree and all that aggravation. You just want to walk people's pets for them and maybe watch their houses. You've decided, I just want to be a babysitter. I like kids. A little too much, perhaps, but I like kids. What I'm trying to get at here is that there is a form of business almost all of you have engaged in your lives at one time or another. You were in business. It was a kind of loosely organized business. You probably took cash, and you probably, being honest people, reported all the income you got on your taxes for what you did. But you were taking money for doing something, for producing a service or possibly a product. And that is what we call a sole proprietorship. It's a one-person operation. And you are all at risk. I mean, the money that you take in is yours. The costs, you personally have to pay them. So this thing, all at risk, becomes quite important as we go on a little further here. All at risk. So as you are mowing one of those lawns one day, you're driving along and you didn't see in front of you that the lady's poodle was there, and you mow the poodle. You're going, you give that dog a show dog trim. She sues you. Now, she's not going to just take your lawnmower and that truck of yours. She can keep going to your personal assets. She can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please her. Mrs. Fox is a great starter kit. Okay, apparently you guys aren't into furries. But the point there is that there is no limit to your liability personally. Everything you own personally can be taken from you in this. But on the... Did I just have a small stroke? Oh, that. God, that pisses me off. I once had the exam up, and I was looking at it, telling some things about the exam, and the mute pops, and boy, people were writing fast. Damn. Okay. The thing of it is, though, you're all at risk, but you do get all the money. Now, you'll just say, well, someone says, can I write you a check? You say, yeah, I'll write it out to me personally, my name. But you don't have to do it that way. I think every state allows you, even as a sole proprietor in this loosely organized business, to apply for and get a fictitious name. What in some states is called an assumed name, in other states it's called a fictitious name. The generic term for this is a DBA. You don't have to do it, but a DBA. Now, out of curiosity, having had a few business courses, do you know what DBA stands for? Doing business as. You apply for it. Now, everything about companies, understand this, everything about companies is state. The federal government really is not a player except at the regulatory and taxing level. So if I want a DBA, I go through the state to get it. And I personally have DBAs of some of my companies. If you listen to my first podcast, you'll hear the very first thing I say is Dark Wraith Publishing presents. Dark Wraith Publishing is a DBA of mine. I went through the state, secured that, and it's protected, it's mine forever, for as long as I live. That's my DBA. And I've got a couple of other DBAs that are active too. So you can actually get a fictitious name. And a little later in the course, I'll even tell you exactly how you go about this. It's not something you do just out of fancy, because once you have this, it's your child. You own this, and so you want to kind of protect it and use it as necessary. But you don't have to have a DBA, but you can't have a DBA. For example, my active corporation, Emergent Light Studio, Inc., began as the sole proprietorship DBA, Emergent Light Studio. It was, in other words, just a fictitious name I was using for myself, for my own artwork. And then I later incorporated and I transferred the DBA ownership to the corporation. But it began as a DBA. So these are some of the qualities. One thing important about a sole proprietorship, and I, Woman, remember I think I told you you're going to die someday? You are. I could even tell you how it's going to happen, but I think it'd make you kind of sad, you know. But you will die someday. When a person dies, the sole proprietorship dies, because the sole proprietorship is just that person. The sole proprietorship just goes away, and there's nothing left of it, because it was just you hiding under maybe a DBA or just like that. So when you die, there will be nothing left of you, not even memories after a generation. Even your cats will forget about you pretty quickly. Know that about sole proprietorship. Its beauty is in its simplicity. Because the money that you take in, you just report on your regular taxes, on your 1040. That's all it is. Just, you know, I made this at my job. Here's my W-2. And I made this in this little side job I had. This goes on a separate line on the 1040 form. That's all there is to it. Very simple organization. But again, you are all at risk. The next one is the partnership. More than one person. And they are jointly and severally all at risk. All at risk. So know this. If you are my partner and you screw up, I am just as liable as you for everything that happens because of that. We earn money. You and I both get that money. And then by the partnership agreement, we divide it up. But we are both all at risk. So there's no protection. If I screw up, they could wipe you out, the litigant. The litigants could wipe you out personally. Take away your home. Sell that Bible of yours on Craigslist. And make your mom and your dad wear furry costumes. Mrs. Fox and Mr. Bear. It's a double starter kit. Anyway. Now, it's not quite as simple because you actually have to go through the state and inform them that there's a partnership in existence. And you do that through filing what's called a partnership agreement. It's a formal document. In other words, you can start a sole proprietorship. You can just, I'm going to do this. But if you're going to be partners, you have to form the partnership and have the state know that this partnership exists. And that's the partnership agreement. So in that way, it's a little more complex. It's a little more complex. And but just like a sole proprietorship, if one of the partners dies, the partnership is over. It's gone. It vanishes with the death of any of the partners. You might think, well, I know partnerships that have been around for 100 years, you know, those ones up in Chicago and all. Not exactly, because you see, the structure of the partnership agreement is that the partnership will roll over to a new partnership upon the death of a partner. It's not the same partnership. It will transfer all of its assets and all of that. But if someday you're a partner and you die, you can't just say, well, my husband gets my partnership. No, he doesn't. No. That partnership's gone. There might be a rollover agreement where he becomes a partner, but it's not that partnership. Know that about partnerships. They are. So what I'm saying about these two guys right here is that they are mortal. They have a finite life because the individuals have a finite life. There is nothing there other than the people. Now, I want to point out something about partnerships. There are actually two kinds. There is the general partnership. Two men in a truck. Something like that. All the partners are managing. They're all doing work in the partnership. They're all at risk. But there's another kind of partnership. And this was one that I actually, as a as an entrepreneur and as a consultant, I got involved in. And they are actually quite common, and they are, some of them are really dull and boring. Some of them are actually quite interesting. This is the limited partnership. And the best way I can describe one of these is to tell you some of them that I did. They were low-income housing for the elderly. Now, there was a program that was run by the U.S. government and by many states for a long time, that the governments would provide low-interest loans and grants for entrepreneurs to build low-income housing for low-income elderly people. The housing, once it was built, the apartments would be rent subsidized so that these old people could afford the rent in a decent apartment. Now, the low-income housing for the elderly program, like I said, was around for many years, very popular, and here's how it would work. I had three other partners. We were the general partners. Now, in order for us to qualify for grants and loans, we had to have money of our own. And then that would be matched by government money, low interest loans, grants, what have you. No interest loans in some cases. So the term that we use for that is we had to commit blood. And sometimes you hear the nice term is commit skin. We had to commit blood. So if we needed, let's say, to build one of these, we would need, let's say, $7 million. So we had to be able to commit $3.5 million blood to it. And then the governments, the state, and the feds would step in and commit the rest for us to build it. And then when the people moved in, they would get cuts in there. They would pay half the market rent, and then the government would pay the rest of the rent for them. But we had to commit blood. Now, here's a term that is absolutely essential for you to know in business. It is OPM, O-P-M. Now, do you know what OPM is? What?
Other people's money?
Indeed, other people's money. You don't spend your own damn money. You find other people to commit money. And that's where the limited partnership plays. A limited partnership has general partners. That's us. We are the ones all at risk. But then what we do is we sell limited partnership units. We sell them for, let's say, we would find rich investors, doctors, lawyers, dentists, architects, successful business people of all kinds. And we would sell units of this limited partnership units. Let's say, and I'll give you an abstract one, $25,000 for one unit. And the rule was that we could do this, but the limited partners could not touch the operations. They had to be completely passive. They couldn't go and help us manage. They couldn't really, we didn't even want them wandering around the properties. Just commit your money, and then we go. And we use that money as the commission of blood, and we get the money from the government, we build it, and then you get, by the agreement, your cut of the profits that we make. So that's the limited partnership. Now, let me tell you how these low-income partnerships would play out. After we got everything built, we got the limited partners in, got the money, got the buildings put up, got the people moved in, got a management company to take care of managing the apartments, taking the rent, and all that. So at the end of every year, we would send the limited partners their cut in two parts, their cut of the asset value increase and their cut of the profit. And for the cut of the asset value, we would send them notices on K-1, you lost, let's say, like $8,000 the first year. The asset value depreciated $8,000, your portion of it. For the profit part, you lost $4,000 last year. So the first year, those limited investors would see a massive loss. And every year after that, they would see losses because the property was depreciating. asset value was declining, and we weren't making any money on paper because we were paying ourselves damn good. They were losing their shirts, and they loved it. They'd call us, "When's your next one coming up? We want in." All the time. The better we did at losing their money, the more they came to us for another limited partnership. Why would they do that? Were they on crack? Is there any reason why that would be a hugely popular thing? Taxes. Because let's do asset. They commit $25,000. That's what they commit for their share. Let's say, just again, these are absolutely abstract numbers. They lose $8,000 depreciation, $4,000 in income, and they get to write that off against their taxable income. These are people who make money in their own world, their own lives and businesses. And all they did was put in $25,000 to shield $12,000 from taxes every year for 10 years, 8 years, whatever. For them, it was a winner like you wouldn't believe, because these guys were in high marginal tax brackets. Protecting $12,000 at 40% tax rate, that meant that every year they were protecting, they didn't pay $4,800 in taxes. You put that over 10 years, that was a darn good investment for them. Over and over, the better we lost, the more they wanted. So not all partnerships are for the purpose of profit. Some are. Don't get me wrong about that. I'll talk about those in a minute. Yeah?
Wouldn't the asset value tax deduction stop after hitting $25,000,
though? Back then, it didn't. No. Back then, no. Now, those sons of bitches have closed the loophole. Just pisses me off.
But you can take as much tax deduction as you like.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, understand that wasn't my problem. They had their own accountants, their own tax people. All I did was offer them the opportunity to do this, and they lined up for it. At those high tax, with that high income, the last dollar they earned in their real business was being taxed out the ass. And so if they could just take that down, that was just pure tax shield to them of the tax rate times the amount that we gave them in losses to recognize. It was a great program. And also, and you think, well, this is all bullshit. Look, at the end of the day, we were building stuff for old people who would have been living in hovels eating cat food. Instead, they were living in nice apartments with paint and decent carpets, and they were enjoying their elderly years. So at the end of the day, yeah, there was a scam involved in a way, one of those dirty tax loopholes you hear about all the time, but it was also benefiting a lot of people. And when they closed these things down, they tightened up the tax laws and all that, well, lo and behold, we have a lot more old people eating cat food and living in hovels because this dirty tax loophole and all those things like that are gone these days because the people who benefited from them weren't as rich as they could have been. Let me tell you about some other limited partnerships. In entertainment, limited partnerships were a huge thing in porno in the 1980s. You get the, look, you needed $250,000. You needed $250,000. 3 days, you got maybe 5 talent, 2 cameras, lights, grip, audio, video editing, and then you got a distributor, print VHS and beta, distribute it. So for $250,000, sure, I'm going to get limited partners, old dirty old men who are going to pay me money to do that. Not pay me. Let me. Okay, pay me to do this kind of stuff and set these up so that, and you could crank out, sell 1 million copies of the tape at sticky adult porn shops here, and what you couldn't sell here, you just distributed to other countries, sometimes smuggling them in black market to the communist countries or into Europe where everyone's ugly anyway and everything's in black and white. It's expanded from there. Distribution of a movie started turning into a limited partnership deal. And then the indie movie market picked it up. They figured out we can raise, to do a solid indie movie, raise $2 million with a limited partnership, set it up, run it, close the partnership, except for the distribution of earnings from the indie movie. You do it right, you get exposure, Cannes, Toronto, some of those festivals, and then you're golden to do the next one. And that's how the indie movie market, some of the best players in it are working these days, including some relatives of mine. And then it expanded into the mainstream movie market, because a lot of mainstream producers, screenwriters, all that, got sick of the Hollywood moguls with their cigars and their precious attitudes and their creativity, creative insistence and all that. They said, we're going to go indie. We're going to do a limited partnership. And you see some of these that have raised the blockbusters. Some of the blockbusters you see out there now were funded limited, because the rich, they just went around the Hollywood circuit and the Hollywood games, and they went directly to investors. And if the movie is a winner, and even a bad movie is usually a winner once it goes to Blu-ray, to Netflix, or something like that, you got the money, and that impresses the investors, and they'll come back for the next round and do another movie with you. Finally, you're starting to see some of the indie bands figuring out that the labels, the standard labels and the standard stuff out of the big houses, why would you do that if you're good enough and you can find the investors, set up a limited partnership for the production and distribution of the music? And it's starting to show up there. Even some of the largest names have turned to limited partnerships for their albums. Some of the groups that are coming back, making their comebacks now, are coming back in limited partnership structures to publish their comeback album. So this is heavy stuff, a limited partnership is. And there are also some of these that are a scam. They're a terrible thing. They lose money, and they are not supposed to lose money, and they rip people off. That's just the reality of it, you know? And then there's the corporation. Which is the pinnacle of the capitalist system. It is entirely different from a sole proprietorship or a partnership, because a corporation is a legal entity of its own. The owners are not liable for the exposures, risk, and costs of the corporation. It exists as its own legal entity. It is a person under the law. Unfortunately, our U.S. Supreme Court has justices that are so ignorant that they thought that meant that it was a person under the Bill of Rights in Citizens United. That's not what it meant, what we mean. When I say it is a legal person, that means that it is responsible for its own bills, not the owners. The ownership is separated. Usually ownership is represented by common stock. Borrowings of money are represented by debt instruments like bonds. And we'll talk about all that later. But know that ownership is represented by stock. And those owners are not liable for the exposures, the risks, and the costs of the corporation. They just aren't. It is a legal entity. It is qualified by the state of incorporation. And once the state recognizes it as a legal entity, the federal government will recognize it too with a federal employer identification number. It is responsible for its own bills. It is responsible for its own risks. The owners are liable only to the extent of what they've invested. They could lose their shirt on that, but that's all. So, in other words, the debt holders cannot cut through the corporate veil, unless you've screwed up and you're mixing funds. They cannot cut through the corporate veil to get to the owner's assets. Those are off limits. And that allows for a lot of good things, but it also allows for bad things too. Because when your risk is limited, that allows you to be more willing to take risk. But it also allows you to be more willing to take risks with OPM, with other people's money. Great example of that would be a Donald Trump. He is touted by the media through his own marketing, his own people's marketing efforts, as some kind of a business genius. You're fired. He's so godly that he can say that and strut around like he is so knowledgeable about business. In fact, he has wrecked many companies. He paid himself huge, got investors, and then when the businesses went tap city, he walks away because it's not his asset. It was a corporation, and it was the money of the investors who believed in Donald Trump that took the ass bath. And Donald Trump just flits on to his next great genius operation that probably fails too, because you are protected personally. Now, that gives you an idea. I'll tell you, I mentioned that my active corporation, Emergent Light Studio, it's a photographic art production and sale of photographic art. I do art shows. So it used to be a sole proprietorship. I quickly turned it into a corporation to protect my own ass, because I could have otherwise be held liable to the extent of injuries or whatever. Give you a great example. Last year at an art show, a big art show, I have things inside of my display tent all up, and I have a couple on easels at the outside, really pretty ones that draw the people in. Those are my draws, really gorgeous artwork on easels on the outside. And people walk by, oh, that's nice. And I go in and I talk to them and pretend I care. But here came this mother by, she had a couple of kids, one of them racing around all hyped up on sugar and autism or whatever the hell, and kicked one of the easels over. A huge framed photographic artwork in glass went flying, hit the ground, glass flew everywhere. And it could have cut people. It could have, as the pieces shot up in the air, could have hit someone in the eye. It didn't. I was kind of hoping it hurt the kid, but it didn't. Then she bitches at me about it. But you see, if someone had been hurt and I sued, as a corporation, they could sue the corporation. They could wipe out the assets of the corporation, but they couldn't touch me and my own assets. But if I'm a sole proprietor, they could have just kept suing and taking everything, wiped out the corporation, taken my camera equipment, my printers, my frame-making equipment, and then gone after my own stuff, my car, my Bible, my dog, and my mom, God rest her soul. Okay? So that's why I'm a corporation. The message is clear. If you're going to have exposures that could go wild on you, get insurance and incorporate yourself. Okay? So that gives you an idea of why the corporate structure. But the problem is that it is insanely complicated. I mean, I spend more time filling out forms for the federal, state, and local government, worrying about regulations, worrying about this new thing, that old thing. I don't even dare hire employees very often because I don't want to get sucked into workers' comp and withholdings and Obamacare. I don't want to get into that. But if I grow enough, I'm going to have to face it. And as a corporation, the regulatory burden, filling out the forms, taking care of all of the needs of all of the bureaucrats who have to have jobs and excuses for what they do, that is awfully, awfully tough. So the corporation protects me, but at the same time, it is a demanding master. And I am its parent. It is a person of its own, but I have the responsibility to protect that person, because it cannot protect itself, because after all, it isn't really a person. It just is a person under the law. Got the idea? That's kind of a basic overview of different structures. And there are some things in here, like in partnerships, you'll see these odd twists, like that architect firms, accounting firms, they'll call themselves LLPs, limited liability partnerships, or things like that. There are all kinds of flavors of that. And then there's these stupid-ass things called LLCs, limited liability companies, that are an unfortunate fad that just won't go away. But these are the basic. These are mortal. That's immortal. It has no end to its life because when the owners die, just new owners are there that take the stock or buy the stock or inherit the stock. The corporation theoretically does not have an end to its life. It can go on forever. And that is the danger of thinking that word person is too much like a real human being person. Because a corporation is an immortal. It doesn't die. It doesn't have feelings. When it commits a crime, you can't put a corporation in prison. You can't, a corporation doesn't shed tears when an employee gets hurt. It's not a person in the real living sense. But legally, yeah, it is. And legally, it's immortal. It's a god that way. Okay, enough of that nonsense. Getting back to some a little bit more interesting things here. Let me see, find someone. You got any money?
Money?
Yeah.
No.
Here's an interesting thing. You are a valuable person. And you're enhancing your asset value through this education and through the life, probably through work experience and just life experience. You have a great deal of value in you. But I need money now, woman. And you don't have any. This is one of the challenges when we talk about money. We really are talking about something that's kind of complicated. One of the most important aspects to start with in the concept of capital or money or whatever you want to call it, is liquidity. The ease and efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. The ease and efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Now, usually when we talk about liquidity, that other asset is cash. So in practical terms, when I talk about liquidity, how quickly can I turn something into cash money? You are illiquid, but you have very high value. I mean, I can turn you into cash, but I mean, I've got to find one of those slave markets and where they're doing the organ donations, and all that kind of stuff. So understand that you have high value, but low liquidity. You could be a very rich person, but have not much money at all in your pocket. You could be a corporation that has an incredible amount of value to it, but you could actually go into bankruptcy because you can't pay your light bill. There are many corporations out there. Have you been introduced to the term brand equity? Have you heard that term? It's the value of a corporation that comes from the brands that it has and their worth. Like, for example, there are companies that have, like, Coca-Cola. That name, Coca-Cola, is insanely valuable. And that's brand equity. There are corporations out there that have this incredible amount of value just in the fact that they own something that everyone recognizes and everyone respects. And that's one of the most important things that I talk about in management classes is a company builds brand equity over a long period of time, but it can lose its brand equity in a New York minute. It really can. And that happens. And then there are companies that they could lose their brand equity through no fault of their own, and they could lose it overnight, and they manage to keep it from happening with how they handle the situation. Because they understand that brand equity, we're not going to give up on that. Great example of that was Tylenol. Some idiot years ago put poison pills in Tylenol bottles and killed a bunch of people. And Tylenol, all the Tylenol was pulled off the shelves. Everyone was told, don't take Tylenol anymore. And somehow the company managed to deal with the situation so gracefully. It's a case study. They saved brand equity, saved their corporation. Tylenol is still as respected today as it was at the time. And then there's other companies that just, the technical term is they screwed the pooch on what happened. There was a company that was growing. It was building brand equity on all natural fruit juices. Had an outbreak of salmonella in its fruit juices. It just sat there on its fat ass, and the company died. Had brand equity that was going on an upward bullet, and it just let it go, and the company's gone now. Other companies have fought they defend their brand equity, suing for companies that you are too close. Great example of that, Jordache jeans. Some years back, Jordache is brand. It's valuable. They found out that there was some company in Mexico that was making large jeans for big women that called its jeans Lardache jeans. I shit you not. They sued that company back to the Stone Age. They stopped it. They didn't want the damage to brand equity. And so, you know, sometimes you can't fight it. And sometimes, actually, it's okay to let go of brand equity if it makes your company better because everyone uses the name of your product. Anyone know a generic name that's actually a product, actually a real product? Yeah? Kleenex. Great example. Yeah? Yeah, Band-Aid. They're bandages, but everyone calls it a Band-Aid, no matter what kind it is. Any others? Yeah? Q-tips. Give me a Q-tip. Doesn't matter what it is. It could be ass tip, but I'll call it a Q-tip. That was just freaking disgusting. Okay. Another one. Dumpster is actually a brand, a name. And it's actually with a capital, even though it might be Al's Bin. There are a lot of them out there like that that actually have a background. And you let other companies even hint that that's their product because it just does you good to do it that way. But anyway, okay, liquidity, though. How quickly can you turn an asset into cash? I might have a 100-share certificate of Microsoft stock right in my car. I still can't get a burger at Burger King with it. I'll pull up to the drive-thru window. I'm going to hand them that. I still can't get my burger. It doesn't have liquidity. I can't turn it into another asset quickly. Houses are very much that way. They provide a great deal of value, but extraordinarily low liquidity. One thing that has happened in the last maybe 10 years, the stock markets are just going ridiculously up, incredibly fast, mainly because our Federal Reserve is just printing money like there's no tomorrow. But the problem is that now that there's no Glass-Steagall, as that money is printed, it goes to the banks, which in the old days would distribute that out through loans and asset appreciation. But now they just move it over into stocks and the stock prices go up. So this concept of liquidity, cash money, the most liquid thing of all, the Fed's creating it, but it instantly evaporates into virtually no liquidity because it's all going into inflation of stock prices instead of going into the general economy. And so it gets kind of complicated that way. A little bit of a note here. When I talk about markets, I'll break them into two different kinds. There are the money markets, and then there are the capital markets. Now, if I'm talking about a money market, what I'm doing is I'm talking about a market where there's an exchange of money that's going to be for less than a year. When I'm talking about a capital market, I'm talking about money that would be exchanged on some longer-term basis. Now, in the same regard, this is where you get one of those things that kind of separates you from the average person in terms of your understanding of how things work. You come to me, you want to borrow $50 for 6 months. Okay, you write me an IOU, $50 IOU. Now, technically, and you'll pay me back with interest. Now, technically, you are the issuer of a debt instrument, and I am its buyer. The price I'll buy it at is $50, with an understanding that I'll get that back in 6 months with interest. So the borrower is the issuer. The other term that you'll hear me use sometimes, the borrower is the writer of the debt instrument. So when you finally achieve that dream of yours of having a double-wide trailer in Decatur, you're going to borrow on a loan from a bank. You are actually the issuer of the debt instrument. The bank is going to buy it for the purchase price of the home, minus any down payment. And you say, well, no, I've seen mortgage things. I didn't write the loan. The bank wrote it. No, they just wrote it on your behalf, and they wrote it in such a way that it would take care of their interests. But the very fact that they are going to push it across the table to you and you sign it first indicates right there you are the issuer. And then once you have issued, it comes back across the table, they sign it, and they have accepted purchase as the buyer. So the borrower is the writer, issuer, and the lender is the buyer, the purchaser. That's how it really works. It sounds a little complicated that way, but that really is how it works. Now, three kinds of debt instruments. Three kinds of debt instruments. There are bills, there are notes, and there are bonds. A bill is any debt instrument that is less than or equal to a year. A note is from 1 to 7 years, and bonds are instruments that are completely satisfied in more than 7 years. So, in other words, when you borrowed for that house trailer, you borrowed on a 20-year promissory instrument. That would be you issued a bond. And the bank that lent you the money was the buyer of the bond. Can you think of a traditional loan that is almost always a note? And almost all of you will... either say it, bingo, right there, car loan. No doubt about it. Car loans are notes. Used or new, they almost always are anywhere from like 3 years to 7 years, typically a 5 year on a new car or a 6 year. But those are notes. Greatest example I could think of. Now, the bill is a little weird because, well, I got a bill in the mail. The electric company sent me a bill. Well, no, not exactly. You were the issuer of the bill. All they did was accept payment for the services they rendered on a monthly basis. So all they're sending is a memorandum of the debt instrument you issued. The bill is your bill. You wrote the bill. And all they were doing was covering your cost of electricity over the time period of the bill. But you're the issuer of the bill. It's pure and simple. That's like in that promise that I owe you. You issued a bill, and I'll remind you of that. I might send you a letter. Here's what you owe me, because you aren't paying it, you son of a bitch. And the thing, though, is that you're the issuer. Let me show you something here. I'm going to do something here. Whoa, Denny's tonight. I'm good. Grand slam, yeah. Woman, at the top of that, take that. Don't get familiar with it. That's mine, okay? What do you see at the top of that? What do you, that top right there, that header in reverse lettering? Say that again.
Federal Reserve Note.
What was that last word? Note. Give it to me. I don't know where you've been. Okay. Note. So in other words, this is a debt instrument, and it's somewhere between 1 and 7 years in duration. Well, how is it a debt instrument? Well, simply because the U.S. government borrows the money from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve recognizes the debt by preparing this debt instrument that is issued by the federal government. The Fed prints it on behalf of the government, lends the government the money, and then distributes these out to the general population. And then during the life of this, it'll get worn out and it'll be chewed up. And how will they pay off this debt instrument? How will the government pay off this debt instrument? Does anyone know how the government will pay off this debt instrument? See, because it borrowed money from the Fed issued this to represent the obligation. But the government says, the Treasury says, instead of giving these back to us, just distribute them to the banks so the banks can distribute them to the businesses and the people. Okay, so this is a debt instrument. The government has to pay it off. It's a note, so it has to pay it off within 7 years. And how does it pay it off? What does the government do to pay it off? Anyone know? Say it. No. That's ours. Government doesn't do that. We do that. The government simply has the Fed print more of these to pay off the old ones and put more money into the economy. That's how it pays it off. It simply has the Fed print more of these, use some of that money to pay off the old debt instrument and shred it, and then there's extra to distribute out into the economy to keep the economy liquid. You got it? In other words, they pay off the debt by issuing more debt. Now, that's actually pretty cool. If you could pay off your bills by just printing money to pay them off and print a little extra for dinner, and that's how it works. That's as simple as I can get, and if that sounds like a scam to you, you better hope to hell that scam keeps going, because if people ever figure out what a scam it is, God help us. Okay, enough of that. Let me do something here real quick. Interest. Where the hell's my coffee? I haven't bothered anyone on this side of the room today. Sir, I'd like to borrow $100 from you. A year from now, I'll give you $100 back. Sound good?
No.
The hell? I'm good for $100. I'll give it to you. I'll give it back to you. Why isn't that a good deal?
I want to make money.
Oh, la-dee-da, another damn capitalist. Yeah, you see, because if you have $100 now, you can use that $100 now. You can buy cheeseburgers. You could buy a girlfriend for a while. Okay, maybe a little more to take, but, you know, for you. No, but here's the deal. You see, you have to be rewarded for giving up immediate consumption. At the heart of every interest rate, there are a lot of things that pile up, and I'll go through those. But underneath everything else, you have to be rewarded if you're going to not have your money now. That's what the basic, most fundamental of all interest rates is. It's basically an opportunity cost for foregoing consumption now. It's an opportunity cost for foregoing consumption now. That's what an interest rate is. It might be something small, 2%, but you got to have a reward just for giving up some enjoyment now in your life. And that's what you mean. No, I you know, you might not even use the $100 today. But it's yours to use. If you give it to me, I ain't going to share it with you. I'm going to go out and buy my own friend. Or cheeseburger. You know, whatever. You understand? Now, here's the next deal. Here's the next thing. Madam, I have decided to employ you. She's backing up, so you're in the line of fire. I'm going to employ you. Now, I'm a really generous employer. You know, you do 60 hours of work a week for me, and we're going to start you out this year at $100 a week. I know, $100 a week, generous, but that's me. Okay. Now, inflation over the course of the year has been 2%. So at the end of the year, I say, you're such a damn good employee, I'm going to give you a raise. I'm going to raise your wage 2%. Okay? You know, cover inflation. Now, before I go any further, notwithstanding that you probably deserve more for merit, but let's just stick to the 2%. Why is 2% a ripoff for you? Well, you're right about that. It's not recognized the merit, but there's something else in there that's not fair. The 2% was coming along all through the year, and I'm going to give you 2% at the end of the year. You've already been kicked. Okay, so now, through the next year, inflation has bumped up to 4%. So at the end of the second year, you come in and I say, well, you know, I'm going to give you 4% raise. Cover inflation. By the way, can you start working 80 hours a week? Damn good of you. Okay. Again, you're being taken for a ride because that 4% was rolling through the year, but you're getting your 4% raise for the next year. The next year, inflation is going at 6%. So at the end of that year, I say, all right, yeah, I'm going to give you a 6% raise. This is where you put your foot down on my neck, with a shotgun pointed at my face. And you say, no, I want 8%. Well, inflation last year was only 6%. Why would you like 8%? What would be your motivation? It would be an expectation. See how inflation had gone 2, 4, 6? You're embedding an expectation that inflation is going to continue to accelerate. It doesn't matter what already happened. What you are interested in is what you think is going to happen. That goes back to that thing I was talking about last time. We don't care about the past. In financial markets, in rational wage negotiations, in all aspects of our greed-driven lives, the past isn't what matters. It's our expectation of the future that matters. So in every interest rate, not only is there going to be that reward for just basically giving up your money, but there's also going to be embedded an expected inflation premium. Not inflation, expected inflation. And that is a little bit more difficult because I could say, well, I heard on the news the Federal Reserve is going to clamp down on the money supply. Inflation is going to go down. I heard it on the news. But what you have seen with your own eyes, 2, 4, 6, 8. So it's not going to be the stated intentions of some diffuse Federal Reserve. It's going to be the reality of the expectation from your own experience that will drive what you want. This is how interest rates work. The most basic interest rate that we see in a market would be called the risk-free rate. We designate this with an R. I keep using R's. If you see me use an R, modern books use a K for interest rates. K sub F. We call this the risk-free rate. Now, the risk-free rate, technically, we can't really see an instrument that actually carries this rate, but we can see something that's very close to this rate. This interest rate carries no risk in it. All it does is carry the opportunity cost of foregone consumption, the real interest rate, we call that. And I wrote an R there, didn't I? K. Plus an expected inflation premium, which I designated as a pi with a superscript E. That's not inflation. That's expected inflation. That's what's bad when the government starts creating too much inflation. Well, it's actually the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve prints too much money for too long, an inflation expectation embeds. And even if the Fed really does try to turn around and stop the inflation, the expectation can hang for a long time. Because we don't care about the intentions. We care about what we have seen out there. So this is essentially, now, do we ever see this in reality? There is an instrument that's actually close. It would be a government treasury bill. A very short-term treasury bill will have a yield that is pretty much the risk-free rate, give or take. And why is it a risk-free rate? Because if the government borrows money from you, it'll pay you back. It will. The government has a sovereign power of taxation, but taxes are kind of a touchy thing, so we'll just invade another country and take their money. I mean, what the hell? They didn't need it. So essentially, a government T-bill is close to the risk-free rate. And now for your last thing, how to figure out a yield on a T-bill. Back in the day, it's not like this now. Back in the day, though, when the government wanted to borrow money, it literally held a physical auction. It would put the paper, different kinds of treasury instruments, on the table. Bonds, notes, bills, things like that. And then it would rich investors, institutional investors, things like that, banks, international sources of money, they would come up and they would buy the instruments. And by buying them, that was lending the government money for its operations. Now, it doesn't really work like that. It's all electronically done now. But the principle is still the same. So what we'll do is we'll hold an old-fashioned auction, just an auction. The government wants to borrow short-term liquidity kind of money. And so it puts T-bills on the table. The first thing to know is that every debt instrument will pay you back $1,000. Corporate or government, the payback amount, the face value is $1,000. Always. I don't have to tell you that. It will be $1,000. If you ask me, well, what's the face value of this instrument? I will eat your ass. I know, gourmet. Okay, so let's have this auction. I am the hostess and the cashier at the T-bill auction. My name is Mabel. And you come in, you're kind of kicking tires looking for something to invest in, and you're walking around looking at these one-year T-bills. One-year T-bills. Now, whatever you buy it at, in 1 year, the government will pay you back $1,000. So clearly, you will want to buy it at a price below $1,000 so that you get your interest is the change from the price you paid to $1,000. Because at the end of 1 year, the government will just send you a $1,000 check. Okay, so you're coming along, and I'm Mabel, and I see you walking along looking at these T-bills, one-year T-bills. Well, hi there, young man. Are you looking at T-bills for investment? Well, we've got a really nice one over here. It's got the same color as that gorgeous, gorgeous skin of yours. We could take care of those zits at my place tonight if you'd like. Come over here, young man. Have a look. Here's a T-bill, and it's going for $975. Would you like to buy it from me? Of course you would. Earl, one T-bill, drag it through the garden, put it in a bag. That'll be $975, sweetie. And here's my number. So let's talk. The price of the T-bill the face value of the T-bill, the dollar interest that you earn, and finally, the yield. Now, I hope you have a calculator. It doesn't have to be a fancy one, just a calculator. So what did I say that the price was? $9.75. Now, in 1 year, how much are you going to get back?
2.5%.
Well, let's say face value is $1,000. Now, what is the dollar amount of interest you earned? Can you tell me that? What's the dollar amount of interest you earned? $25. So now we can calculate the yield. The yield is going to be how much did you make, $25, divided by how much you invested. How much did you invest? $9.75. Do not put $1,000 down there. God, that twists my thong. Don't. I will put it on the test. The multiple choice question, I will make sure that the answer that you would get if you put $1,000 down there is right there for you. Yes, I am an asshole. I will make sure that if you do the calculation wrong, you'll see your answer there. It's how much you made over how much you invested. Now, what does that come out to be? 0.02. Give me four decimal places. 2656. Now, this is an important thing in my class. Unless otherwise specified, all answers round to two decimal places of accuracy. Two decimal places. Don't impress me because your stupid calculator can do 13 decimals. Don't round it up to the nearest place. Two decimal places, that's house rule. Now, every organization will have house rule like this. The most common one is the two decimal place rule because it's dollars and cents is where it came from. Two decimal places. So 2.56%. Well, okay, well, that was cool. You made 2.5. You know, you say, well, that's kind of crummy. Well, it's a government instrument. It's risk-free. What do you want? So here you come back to the next auction. Well, there you are again. How nice. Yes. Really nice to see you again. What a wonderful, you got your $1,000 check and you want to go to it again. Oh, you're such a nice young man. Do you have a girl? I've never seen you with a girl. Do you come from Penn State Athletic? Too soon. Too soon. I'm going to hell. Look. But you look around you, I said, well, $9.75. And you look around and you say, you know what? I don't see anyone here buying. So you say to me, I'm not paying $9.75 because there's no demand for these. Offer me something. $9.50. Do it again. $9.50. $1,050, and here's the last thing, you're going to have to write down this important principle. What's $50 divided by $9.50? 0.0526. So now you tell me one of the most fundamental universal principles of finance. As the price goes down, what happens to the yield? Well, spank me, Jesus. You have just seen your first fundamental law of finance. Price goes down, yield goes up. Price goes up, yield goes down. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.